Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia on the 19th of December 2015. My name's Hereward Fenton. Welcome to the show. Folks, this show is about giving a voice to the voiceless. It is about bringing to light information that is continually suppressed for reasons of power and control throughout the world. And every week I find there's an amount of material which sort of piles up on my desk, and I'm driven by the need to address things that come up, things that often come up in the mainstream media but only to disappear again very quickly. And today's show is going to be focused on something that popped up in the news this week, which we'll probably hear nothing further about, but it is the tip of the iceberg of a massive, massive problem related to so many other issues that we talk about on this show. And it is the question of electroconvulsive therapy, which is now routinely used. Apparently, 30,000 electroconvulsive therapy treatments per year are delivered in Australia. I mean, that's an extraordinary number for such a small country. And along with other psychiatric treatments, electroconvulsive therapy has very strong support from within the psychiatric mainstream world, and there are massive opponents and opposition groups to the use of this therapy, as it's so called, which actually involves putting an electric current through a person's brain while they are strapped down and anesthetized and given a muscle relaxant to prevent bone breakage from violent seizures. The treatment, as it's called, I really, you know, think that using the word treatment, using the word therapy, is a total bastardization of the English language. But let's just go along with that, since that's how the mainstream medical community uses the word. The treatment induces essentially a grand mal seizure. The effects of this are both short-term and long-lasting. Now, the short-term effects are actually the more positive effects. The long-lasting effects are much more serious and are anything but positive. I'm going to be playing to you a number of interviews and audio clips today, but I want to preface that just by talking about what appears to be the control of opinion from within medical science, which I believe is really driven by power and money more than anything else. Now, the story that I'm going to present to you today is actually about a man who is currently in a psychiatric facility in Australia, and he is actually suing the government, or suing the hospital, for involuntary ECT treatments. And this actually ended up going on the 7:30 Report, which is a nationwide television show in Australia. Now, when I posted this article and posted my opinion about it, I was more or less set upon by a group of very, very pro-ECT people on Facebook, some of them claiming to be those, you know, professionals working within the industry. I think they might have been nurses mainly. And I was told I was an idiot. I was told, you know, I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm not entitled to an opinion. I'm just spouting off crackpot theories. And what I found, you know, it's extraordinary the degree by which these people rush to the defense of this practice. But it's understandable when you consider that that this is a huge industry, and ECT itself is one of the more profitable medical industries, because it involves so many different technologies and so many different experts. So you've got to have an anesthesiist, on site to deliver the anesthetic. The machines themselves are quite complex and expensive. The procedures generate a lot of money, and they generate a lot of profits for a variety of different stakeholders. And what we see in the kind of knee-jerk response to any criticism and the smackdown of people who have different, who basically just raise the clearly obvious issues about it, that this is by all intents and purposes, this is an assault on a person's brain. It is a form of head injury without actually the physical concussion, but it is actually a type of concussion. It does create within the brain the same effect. And the consequences of this having electricity pulse through the brain are the same as what we know from vast amounts of direct experience from car accident victims and other victims of head trauma injury, is that the disorientation, there is a change of emotional affect, and sometimes that's for the better, but it's a sudden and totally unnatural change in emotional affect. Sometimes it's a resulting apathy, sometimes it's a result in delirium, and sometimes it's a result in a kind of a manic type of behavior. Because damaging the brain in this way has unpredictable effects. But one thing it does do is it does change the state of the person. And this is generally regarded as a positive outcome, because most of the people who go in for this treatment are already in a state where they have been undergoing all kinds of other psychiatric treatments. They're generally in a very, very low state. They're generally lost all hope. These people, and most for the most part, they volunteer for it. It's the relatively unusual case, like the story we're going to cover today, where it's done involuntary. But it's offered to them as a solution, and the coordination of medical staff, doctors, and the pharmaceutical industry, the medical industrial complex, creates a really powerful psychological motivator for them to believe that this actually will solve their problem. I mean, there are so many advocates of it, and there are so many people who will say that it is the lifesaver, it is the thing that will restore you. And of course, when you go through this procedure, you certainly will be different. There's no doubt about it. You won't be the same as you were when you started. And that in itself can be interpreted as a positive thing for people who've been in a hopeless, stagnant state of mental illness for many years. And as we know, with brain trauma, often there is a change of emotional state. And often people do say they feel better. But this is actually a recognized symptom of brain damage. So the fact that someone reports that they feel better, or that they don't feel bad the way they used to feel, in this case cannot be used as primary evidence to say that the treatment was successful. It can also be used as evidence to show that this person has been brain damaged. And it's worse than that, though, folks. It's much worse than that. Because the research has shown that these benefits, when they do occur, are only short term. The longer term prognosis is that they will slip back into whatever state of depression they were already in, and there is no improvement on the suicide rate. So there is at best a short term improvement subjectively in the patient's state of mind, but this is coupled with memory loss. And the memory loss is severe and often prolonged. And it's not the same in every case. Of course, some people do recover their memories, but many don't. And in the show notes of today's show, I'll be providing all kinds of information on that, including court cases where patients have been awarded massive settlements because of the memory loss that occurred as a result of this treatment. Now, what is amazing, I think what's actually going on here is that the general public is generally unaware of this. Most people have no idea this is even going on. And the first time you hear about it, you probably think, my God, I thought they stopped doing that 50 years ago. It's something that actually took off again in the late 1970s after a period of a hiatus where it wasn't done. And then it became a huge industry. And now, really, it is one of the centerpieces of modern psychiatry. And, of course, you'll have all manner of people coming forward to say that that it's great. And they'll say, well, you know, there are side effects and they're all treatments have side effects and we have to deal with that. But, this has saved many people and blah, 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 blah. Well, today I want to go through some of the details on it. And when we come back from the break, I'm going to play to you the ABC interview and story on it, on this case of the man who is actually suing a hospital in Sydney for a 31 an involuntary ECT treatments, 31, and that's actually far more than is usually a given. And he's actually able to speak. He's actually interviewed in the television report. And you can see this person, I mean, he's obviously mentally ill. I'm not going to dispute that. But, you know, he's able to talk and he's able to walk and he's able to get up and he's able to sit down. I mean, obviously this man has serious problems, but it's not like he's a vegetable who has to be kind of shocked into being functional again. This is what you often hear as a reason why ECT is used as the last resort. They say it's for people who basically can't do anything for themselves. I don't know the details of this particular case. And no doubt those who support it will say, well, the fact that he's able to walk around and talk in the interview is proof that the treatment actually worked. I don't know what his state was before they actually started the treatment. They said he was put in restraints. They said for several months he was actually physically restrained. Now, what's necessary to understand? There's two sides to this, which are most important. One is the question of people's choice and the rights of an individual, the sovereignty over one's own body. The second is the way in which society facilitates a profit-driven industry which is built around procedures that many people regard as being damaging and dangerous and which can be funded through Medicare, which ultimately comes out of your tax. So the question isn't, for me, it's not so much whether this should be banned, although I think it probably should be banned, but whether it should be funded by the taxpayer. We're going to break with Truth News Radio Australia. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and my name's Herewood Fenton. Great pleasure to be with you today. And do check out our website at truthnews.com.au. And if you like what we do, why not think about becoming a subscriber? It's a very, very easy process, and $65 for the year, and we'll send you a lovely Truth News Australia t-shirt if you decide to join up. Now, I'm going to play to you the 7:30 report clip now. And it's actually quite good and gives quite a lot of information, and it gives you some perspective on both sides of the debate. And after that, I want to play to you a couple of other audio clips. One is from a person who actually underwent ECT, and it's a very articulate young lady who talks about what actually happened to her and the details of it, which are quite eye-opening. And then I want to play to you an interview with Dr. Peter Breggin, actually a debate with Dr. Peter Breggin, who is one of the few people within psychiatry who is against this procedure and many other psychiatric treatments. He's a believer in holistic health and healing through the support of the patient, through understanding the substantive nature of what it is they're going through, the psycho-spiritual crisis, as he calls it. And this is a man with extensive medical training, but he ended up realizing that all these interventionist, all these biochemical treatments were in the end far inferior to the basic treatment of kindness and understanding, of which is what people with severe depression need most of all. They need to feel that they have a support network and they need to restore hope in their lives. They don't simply need their biochemical system to be fixed. They don't need a technician to go in and fiddle with the wires in the back of their head. But see, that's what the model of modern psychiatry is all built on. It is built on the idea that the human being is kind of like a robot and you just have to kind of fiddle with the wires or maybe send an electric pulse through, inject something into it, and it's kind of an it rather than a person to make it better. So now, without further ado, let me play to you the interview here from ABC News. And this was recently, this was on Thursday, the 17th of December. Here we go.
Electroconvulsive therapy has had a long and controversial history. After falling out of favour for many years, its popularity is now on the rise. But is it ever acceptable to apply shock therapy against a patient's will? One Melbourne man is suing a psychiatric hospital for doing just that. Garth Daniels has been shocked 31 times in the last 4 months, and he's also been tied to his bed with Velcro straps for much of the year. Louise Milligan met him and his family.
Out by the Agapanthus bushes, an involuntary psychiatric patient has come for a smoke with his dad.
Continue giving me shock treatment, keeping me here.
Garth Daniels is 40. He's been in and out of mental health institutions for 2 decades, and his medical file will tell you he can be a very dangerous man.
It's okay.
This morning, Garth had a dose of electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT. It's his 31st session since August, despite the fact that he and his father have begged the hospital not to subject him to the treatment. What do you feel about the fact that you're being given ECT?
I don't agree to it at all.
Why is that?
Because it affects my memory, and my memory is extremely poor at the moment.
But the hospital is continuing to give Garth ECT against his will. As he chats to 7:30 outside his Upton House psychiatric ward, the impact of the treatment on his memory is clear.
I've forgotten. I can't remember, unfortunately.
Do you remember what's happening tomorrow?
No.
My view of it's like taking a 10-ton hammer, hitting it on someone's head, and you have a headache so you don't feel anything else. I think it's draconian. I think it should be outlawed.
ECT, once known as shock therapy, is an electrically induced seizure. It was first used in the 1930s. The stigma around shocking patients meant ECT was shunned by psychiatry in the 1970s. But in recent years, ECT has been much more safely administered with anaesthetic, and it's had a major resurgence in popularity.
We adopt a judicious and discerning approach to the use of ECT, but the clinical effects are just absolutely remarkable.
Garth Daniels has just been scheduled for a further 12 ECT treatments. It'll be overseen by Eastern Health's head of psychiatry, Professor Paul Katz, bringing the total number to 43.
That's far more than is generally given to patients, right?
Louise, that's correct.
Health Department guidelines state that the more ECT a patient is given, the more risk they have of severe cognitive side effects.
We feel that the risks of ECT are less than the benefits in terms of Garth's well-being. Garth has a very, very severe chronic mental illness, which is pharmacologically treatment resistant. And Garth, more recently, we introduced ECT into his treatment regime, and the treating team have not seen Garth this well in our long association with him and his family.
The Daniels family begs to differ.
Oh, hi. They wanted me to meet you.
Bernard Daniels has for the second time flown in Queensland psychiatrist Dr. Jock McLaren to assess his son. Dr. McLaren has seen Garth and has written a report saying, in his opinion, Garth has the mental capacity to refuse consent for ECT. That opinion is backed up by Garth's private treating psychiatrist.
Just come in, have a chair.
Jock McLaren mainly sees veterans with PTSD and has worked in remote Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory as chief psychiatrist.
So things are not going very well at all?
No, not really.
I don't use ECT. It's as simple as that. And for 40 years, I haven't used ECT, working often alone in some of the most dangerous parts of the country with very, very difficult people. I don't find the need to use ECT.
What do you do instead?
Talk to people.
The Daniels family is also concerned at Eastern Health's prolonged use of mechanical restraints on Garth.
The actual process will involve us restraining the patient around his or her wrists and or ankles, but it's a Velcro. It's not it's not the picture sometimes painted of some draconian, you know, chain, the person's chain. That's not quite correct.
Although Garth initially agreed to being restrained to control his aggressive outbursts, at one stage earlier this year he was strapped to his bed for more than 60 days in a row.
When Garth becomes unwell, it's really precipitous. It's characterised by Garth becoming extremely aggressive, assaultative, unpredictable and very impulsive. So we certainly have a duty as a treating team to primarily keep Garth safe under those circumstances.
I'm just going to pause it there because I want to make an observation here. And as I said that, I've been doing a bit of reading on the promotional aspect of ECT, and they say it's often used for people who are unresponsive to treatment, and they give the example of someone who's become catatonic, someone who just won't get out of bed, who's lost all hope in life. But clearly, this man, Garth Daniels, is not in that kind of state. He's obviously violent. He's obviously a threat to hospital staff. And this clearly is the reason why, after having putting in restraints for months, and in the video there you can see the scars caused by that. He was strapped to his bed for months at a time. And, of course, that didn't work. It probably just made him more angry, right? So then they decided to shock him. So this looks more like a method of managing a patient who has become impossible from the perspective of the hospital to manage. And, you know, I understand that they're afraid they're going to be injured. I mean, I sympathise with hospital staff, but is it possible that the whole system is wrong, the whole approach is wrong, that it's actually degrading and dehumanising, and that it's creating more problems than it solves? We're going to break with Truth News Radio Australia. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And talking today about electroconvulsive therapy, shock therapy, as it's sometimes called. And a shocking story from Australia about a man who has been involuntarily put through this procedure 31 times and is scheduled for another 12 treatments. And he is suing the hospital, suing the health department. And this ended up on ABC, and it's become quite a big news story. And as I mentioned earlier, I put this up on Facebook, and you know, I was told to, I'm you know, not qualified to have an opinion by a number of people who claim to work in the health industry. And most people just ignore it. Most people don't want to know about it. Those who work within the health industry tend to just blindly support it. And I've seen the same thing with vaccines. I've seen the same thing with other types of treatments that are, you know, cancer treatments, etc. The industry of the mainstream medical system basically says there is one way of doing things, and they say, you know, this is fine because we do all this testing, we're so wonderful, you know, you can't question us because we're perfect, because we always test everything, and we're, you know, and these terrible crackpot people like homeopaths and these, you know, alternative people, oh, they're just terrible, you know, because they don't have all the checks and balances that we have in the wonderful hallowed halls of medicine. It's just a racket, basically, folks. But it's a racket which is very, very dangerous and very, very powerful. Now, let me continue with the ABC piece here. And just to mention again, in the interview there, they had a psychiatrist from Queensland who said he hasn't practiced ECT in 40 years. He says he doesn't have a need for it. And they said, what do you do? He says, I talk to people. You see, this is actually what people need who are mentally troubled, is that they need communication, they need support. Anyway, let's continue with the piece from the ABC. Here we go.
But similarly, we have a duty of care to keep other patients safe, as well as our staff.
National Mental Health Commission Chair Professor Alan Fells says the Commission has more complaints about the overuse of restraints than anything else.
I think there's almost universal agreement that restraint has no therapeutic value, doesn't improve people, and often it adds to their problems. It increases their feelings of mental illness.
I would never restrain any human being for 69 days straight. End of discussion.
Garth's father, Bernard, is banned from the ward for giving his son food on the morning he was due for ECT and for taking him for a second opinion during a rest weekend.
They kept telling me, why don't you just be a dad? And I said, well, I am being a dad. And I'm being a dad because I have his medical power of attorney. And when I have to make decisions for him, I'd like to know that I'm doing everything possible.
The relationship between the Daniels family and the hospital has now become so vexed that Garth Daniels has issued a writ in the county court. It's using the tort of assault, trying to stop Garth from being subjected to any further ECT or mechanical restraints, saying it's an unlawful trespass against him. Professor Paul Katz says ECT is the last available option for Garth, but he believes it could be avoided by the use of a drug called clozapine, a last resort antipsychotic.
Clozapine's been around for many, many, many years. It's extremely effective for exactly this genre of patient, i.e. somebody who has a pharmacological treatment-resistant psychotic illness. We would normally want to put them onto clozapine. Unfortunately, and most tragically, neither Garth nor his family are supportive of that intervention.
I'll just leave it there. You can watch the rest of it. You can see that the attitude of a psychiatrist here is they're treating Garth Daniels as an it rather than as a person. They're just saying we're going to give it this treatment or that treatment, and you know, it's not a person. The concept that his violence, that his mental instability is actually due to some real psychological dare I say, spiritual causes is so foreign to these people that there is actually a wall of impenetrable wall of ignorance. And bear in mind, these people are incredibly powerful in our society and they make massive amounts of money. The whole system generates massive amounts of cash. And I would say that these psychiatrists who practice within this genre of brutality, they are actually the ones who are the most mentally disturbed. They are in a state which is a very bizarre kind of disorder where they perceive a human being as something like a robot or a slab of meat. And it's partly because of all their training and all of the, just everything that supports them in what they do, it tells them that that is the case. And I said on Facebook, I said, we need a revolution, albeit a peaceful one. But we need a revolution. We need a revolution in our thinking, ladies and gentlemen, to get away from this totally dehumanized concept of what a person is. You see, the psychiatrists, like the other one that we heard from, and Peter Bregan, who I'll play to you next, they're very successful when they actually treat a person as a person. But the vast majority of the ones working within the system, they can't do it. They don't have the capacity for it. They say, oh, we're too busy, there's too many people. The fact is, they're not capable of it. There is something wrong. There is something broken in our education system, and there is something broken in the psyche of these individuals that they end up falling into this power control fascist system that is just about processing people like a sausage factory. Now, I want to play to you now a YouTube clip from about 8 or 9 years ago by a lady who actually went through the process of ECT. And she writes a bit. Her name is Liz Spickle, and we'll just play that to you now, and I probably won't be able to play the whole thing. Let's just start it. Here we go.
So when I went to get ECT, and I'm in the hospital, and I'm on the psych ward, and they're telling me, the psychiatric nurses, who are so burnt out, they don't really give a shit. They're telling me, don't worry. Shock treatments are no longer brutal. It's a walk in the park. It's easy. You go in, they put you to sleep, you wake up, and you feel better. That's all. Sounds good, right? But then they told me to put on the diaper. I knew it wasn't going to be a walk in the park. Because the diaper implies a lack of control. I thought I wasn't going to have any kind of major convulsion. Why in the world, then, would I need a diaper? Apparently, I'm going to piss myself and maybe worse. So that was kind of how it began. You get into the diaper. Then you get into the room, and it's kind of like a short procedure room. You know, I got up on the table, and at this point, I really was about to piss myself anyway from complete and total fear. But I got up on the table, and I'm already thinking, you know, I'm wearing a diaper. Things are not good. Then they give you a mouth guard. Now, I don't have a mouth guard here because I don't own a medical supply shop or anything.
We're just listening to an audio clip there by Liz Spickle, who underwent ECT surgery in the 1990s. And when we come back from the break, I'll continue with that. Her description is very interesting. It raises a lot of very important points, which are often ignored by the supporters and the fanatical believers in this treatment. We'll be back. Stay with us.
What happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm going to continue playing a clip here from Liz Spickle talking about her experience with ECT. And then if we have time, I'm going to play a little of a debate between Dr. Peter Breggin and a mainstream psychiatrist. Here we go. Returning to the interview.
So the mouth guards come kind of in like small and large, but I am very small. I am a 5 foot tall person with an extremely small mouth. That's it. I mean, that's as wide as it opens. Not only is it a mouth guard, it's a mouth guard with a handle so they can rip it out of your mouth if they need to. Why are they putting it in your mouth to begin with? Because you are going to have a convulsion, of course. You're going to have such a convulsion that you could bite your tongue off. Or maybe gnash your teeth together in a way that would destroy them. You're going to have a convulsion that may cause you to lose control of your bowels. This is not a walk in the park. They do give you sedation. I kind of said goodbye to everybody while I was counting backwards from 100 or whatever. You know, you get to 98 and you're out. The next thing you know, you're awake. The first thought I had was, where am I? Who am I? What is I? What is this place? I have never been so dislocated from my own identity as I was in that moment after ECT. I had no idea what was happening. I looked around and nothing seemed familiar, which brings up this kind of philosophical question. If nothing seems familiar, how do you know that it doesn't seem familiar? But somehow you know. You know that you are lacking an understanding of the material world, and you are lacking an understanding of your internal world, your interior world, and you want to understand. So they put you in the wheelchair, they wheel you out, and there are a bunch of other zombies in wheelchairs sitting in this recovery room. My parents came over very concerned, you know, honey, it's us, we're here, are you okay? The pain in my jaw was real. Like in the middle of everything, the cell phone. The pain in my jaw was terrible. I had a headache. Every muscle of my body hurt. I wanted to communicate with the world, but I was trapped inside myself. I couldn't speak. I couldn't make a gesture. I couldn't move my facial muscles. I was a prisoner in my own body. They wheeled me up to my room, got me out of my bed. They might have given me an injection for the nausea, which you also feel. And slowly, I returned to an awareness, not of myself, but an awareness of the bed, the lamp. My parents came into focus. It's a really strange feeling. one minute you are a savvy person, albeit depressed. Just an hour later, you feel like you've been hit over the head with a frying pan, thrown under a train, and awakened from a 5-year coma. It's completely overwhelming. The reason, I believe, that you don't feel depressed in that moment is because you don't feel anything. You have been so severely disconnected from yourself. It's impossible to feel depressed. That feeling of not elation, but sort of self-immolation, negation, I feel like it's all starting to rhyme, that feeling lasts for days as you try and construct yourself again. You try and remember, how did I used to brush my teeth? Because you know how you have that little rhythm with the toothbrush? You know, like I always, you don't even think about it, but when you brush your teeth, you have a rhythm that you're into. First you do it on this side, then you do it on this side, then the top, then the bottom, then the in, the end. Think about it the next time you go to brush your teeth. Because after the ECT, I did not know how to use a toothbrush. And that lasted for months. I didn't know how to wash my hair. How did I used to do this? Everything was like this enormous project. Pour the shampoo into your hand. Smack it on top of your head. And then what? Rub? Rub it around? I had, I think, 6 more ECT treatments. I stayed in the hospital for some of them. Every single time before the treatment, I would beg my parents. I don't want to do it. I would cry. It was deeply traumatic each time. But I knew I had to keep going because this was my last resort. I'll just say this, and then we'll move on. I mean, we'll stop talking. That's what I mean by move on. 1 year later, almost to the day, I was back in a psychiatric facility after a suicide attempt. ECT did not work for me. And that 1 year later, I still couldn't remember much of my previous life. And now, 10 years later, well, see, this is the point. My cognitive functioning is still damaged, and my memory is still gone.
So there we have it. There's a very powerful personal statement about what happened. And of course, that's just one individual. But the things she's talking about, the things she's describing, are standard. And the culminating suicide attempt that occurred 1 year after her treatment is further evidence that this treatment only has, at best, a short-term benefit. And she highlights there the fact that the short-term benefit is actually the result of the injury. After the treatment, you lose all perception of who you are. And, of course, that creates a complete break in your consciousness. And so at that point, you can't be depressed. But then as you begin to recover who you are, as you begin to put together the pieces of who you are, your person reassembles itself, and guess what? The depression returns, because the depression is linked to who you are. Unfortunately, we're not going to have time to play the interview there with Dr. Breggin. I might do this next week, because I've got so much material to get through here. I just want to really focus on this point that the human being is a person. We are people. We have a history. There is a reason why we feel the way we do. It's partly a product of genetics, sure. It's partly a product of diet. It's partly a product of our environment. And it's also, most importantly, the construction of who we are over time. It's about our experiences that made us what we are. And happiness and fulfillment are all about that journey heading in a direction which is more than just superficially, hey, I feel good. It's about your life having meaning. Now, when we say meaning, there is no biochemical marker for this. When we talk about the totality of your existence needing to have meaning, this is not something a neurologist or a biochemist can be involved in. But what's actually happened is that psychiatry has become simply a science of managing chemicals in the brain. And this is such a profound issue because it affects far more than just the extreme cases, such as we've seen in today's show, of people who are locked up in mental institutions and restrained with Velcro straps or end up committing suicide. There is a much wider problem in society, and all psychiatric healthcare people will tell you that depression is a much bigger problem than what most people recognise. And yet we have this issue where the primary problem here, because it's treated as a purely medical thing, as a purely quantifiable problem that would be dealt with by fiddling with the wires or, you know, giving you some pills or shoving some electricity into you. The nature of people's despair, the nature of people's hopelessness, the reasons for it are not being explored. And you know what? That's part of why our society is going down the drain. It's why I do this show. I hope today's show has been of some use to you. I'm going to continue with more on this theme. I'll be back with Truth News Australia next week. See you then.